Welcome in, everybody. Welcome in to another episode of the Buddhist Biohacker. Welcome to everyone who is joining in the live. It's so good to see everybody. My name is Lisa. I am your host, as always, of the Buddhist Biohacker program. And I'm absolutely thrilled to be back today with one of our favorite monthly features with Satyam. And it's called Living Yoga. And hi, Anne. Welcome in. Everyone who's joining in the live, you guys can share where you're from. You can ask questions throughout, use those comment boxes, and welcome in Satyam. I'm so happy to have you back.
Oh, wonderful to be here. It's been looking forward to it. It's really great to be here and to go over the topic and to talk with you today.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear all about what you have to say about Buddha's story and the yogis, because I've read so many different versions of the story and Buddhist texts and all sorts of things. And so I'm excited and ready to dive in.
Yeah, hopefully we have a little bit of overlap from what folks know already about Buddha. And hopefully there's some new things or maybe new perspectives, or I'm also looking forward to hearing what folks have their reflections on it as well. So should be an interesting little talk here.
Yeah. Yeah. Where do you want to start?
Well, how about with Buddha's birth? Why don't we go over a little bit? Sometimes, you know, when I studied philosophy in undergraduate, we rarely learned about the philosopher and just studied the philosophy. And I always felt like whereas in the East, it's different. The philosopher has to represent the philosophy. Whereas in the West, you know, a lot of the Western philosophers, it's just something intellectual that they did, a lot of the Western philosophy, and how they lived their life was, you know, off the table pretty much. But so let's get right into Buddha, who he was, what family he was born into, when, where, how, why, all that type of stuff.
Yes, I'm excited. I'm ready.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, he came onto the planet about 2,500 years ago. The exact time, or they say that his birth was 563 BC, about 2,600 years ago. And he was born in, there must have been something in the water in that area, because not only was he born, but just in the village next door to him, another person was born who also had a tremendous impact on and shaping the world. And they both preached interesting philosophies of mercy and forgiveness. That was part of Buddha's teachings of mercy and forgiveness. And also someone who grew up to be known as Mahavir Jain was born in the village next door, just about. And he founded the Jain religion, you know, a massive religion. So the two of them were born same time, same area, and they both had long standing effect on this planet. So it's kind
of, that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, they may have played kickball together, I don't know, but they were close by each other. They were close by. So Buddha was born, and for those familiar with yogic texts and yogic philosophy and who are looking to contextualize this in a time zone, time frame, Maharishi Patanjali, the philosopher who codified the eight limbs of yoga, he was born about 200 or 250 years after Buddha was on the planet, about 2,200 years ago, something like that. So just so you have a basic where we are in the realm of yogic thought and understanding. So Buddha was born in a town known as, he was born on a full moon, Purnima, in the spring, in a town known as Lumbini, which is present-day Nepal, but was India at the time. And his mother was, he was born into a regal family. He was born into great wealth and great name. It was a kingdom. And his mother was Queen Mayadevi, and his father was King Suddhodana. And they were, it was the Kshatriyan era. Each and every society goes through different eras where a certain class or community is ruling. For instance, right now in the US, the present day, we're in capitalism, where the the moneyed class is ruling. It's capitalists in power. Those days in Buddhist time, it was Kshatriyan. So it was the warrior class, those who were fighters, kings, and people who had taken over kingdoms. And so he grew up in a Kshatriyan community, and he into a family of tremendous wealth. And he was the born prince. And his name was, at the time of birth, his name was Siddhartha. And those of you may also know that that's the name of a Hermann Hesse novel that's kind of based on Buddha's life, but not really. So if anyone read that book, I've read that book in the past. It's kind of a romantic book, but it's not all that accurate. And even the philosophical principles are a little bit off, but it's a nice book to read. Depending where you are in your journey, you might enjoy the book, and you may have grown out of the book also. But that Siddhartha, that title, that text, that's Buddha's born first name, Siddhartha. And his family name was Gautam. So he was born as Siddhartha Gautam, a young boy. And he grew up a pretty much a privileged life. His name is Siddhartha, means one who achieves the goal. And boy, were they ever accurate on that one. I mean, talk about a name that comes to fruition. Some names for people, like Buddha, was the name he got later on when he became enlightened. But so the given name doesn't always match, but that one did match, that he did achieve the goal. He did do it.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. His mother, Queen Maya Devi, actually died about a week after Siddhartha was born, just a week after. So he grew up, naturally he had nannies and all those servants and things in the kingdom. But his father realized pretty quickly that he had a pretty precocious and advanced boy. As he watched the boy grow up, the father's great wish, especially those days, was succession, for his son to succeed him as the king. So he did everything imaginable to have his son comfortable and happy in the kingdom. He did not want his son to know of any suffering. So he supplied everything to make his son's childhood wonderful, fun, joyous, all the things. And he had the means, he had the wealth and the power to do so. But he knew that he had an advanced son, someone who's not just your normal run-of-the-mill kid. And this story from his childhood is indicative of that, is that one time Buddha was wandering. He used to like to go around and wander the grounds and the areas within the kingdom. And he was walking through the forest one day, and he used to take note of all the various birds and wildlife. And he was watching one bird on a tree, or a collection of birds, and side by side, his cousin was also in the forest, coming from a different angle. And his cousin, his name was Devadutt. And his perspective on life was a little bit different. He had gone out there with his little blow shooter to shoot darts. And sure enough, he angled in on a particular bird sitting there just on the perch, and he took up his blow shooter and shot, and it knocked the bird off. And that was where Buddha was also looking from the other. The boy Siddhartha was also looking at it from a different perspective, and they both converged on the kill site because the bird was crying out in pain. And Siddhartha got there first, and he removed the arrow and started petting the bird, trying to stop the bleeding and get the bird comfortable. And he gave the bird some comfort. And Devadutt then arrived. They were a similar age, 12 or 14, whatever they were at the time. And Devadutt saw the bird and he said, "Hey, that's my bird. I shot it. I knocked it off its perch. That's mine." And Buddha was philosophical back then. He says, "Oh, well, you see, I found the bird and I'm taking care." And this raises an interesting question. Who is the owner? The one who kills or the one who cares? Who's the owner? And that became a great ethic throughout Buddha's life. And it also runs strikingly interesting with today's capitalism. You know, is it the owner, the person who buys the forest land and clear cuts it for his own personal gain? Or is it the one who doesn't own the land by legal tender, but is caring for it, planting the trees, making it a sustainable resource for humanity? And we have that conflict in capitalism. Okay, just because someone has the money to buy something, are they, okay, in this day and age, they're looked upon as the owner, but is that really the right sense of ownership? And that's come into question in different ways. In our societies, who start to question it, that what does ownership mean, and who is the rightful owner? Mm-hmm. No longer can you own enslaved peoples. You know, you can't say that's my person or that's my. So that continues to come into play. But Buddha did not need early on, from as an early adolescent, he understood that sense of that became an ethic of his life of live and let live, and let there be, we should live a compassionate life. He had that in his bloodstream all from early on. You know, he had a very good samskara. His mind was developed, advanced. He was not your normal kid by any means. And so, and the father did everything he could to quench the desires of his boy, because he realized that he had a real, borderline saint on his hands, and he did not want to lose his son. But later on, his son started to make journeys out into town, and he saw that the world was not always exactly as his father had portrayed it. And it wasn't just a bucket of roses or basket of roses or there was other things. And he made three successive trips to town, and they say the first time out he saw an aged person. And he thought, oh, look at that. People get old and decrepit. I see this life doesn't go on forever. And then the second time out, he saw someone who was sick and diseased. And he thought, health doesn't also last forever. And the third time out, he saw a corpse in the street. And he said, look, this life is fleeting. And then the fourth time out, he saw a wandering monk. And then he thought, he came back to his kingdom, and he, at that point, he was pretty much reconsidering his life, what life was, what it was meant to be, what should be pursued in life. And he had a strong penchant to join that monk life. And sure enough, at the age of 29, in the middle of the night, he left the kingdom. And he went into the forest, and he lived with the monks. He lived with the yogis, and he learned all the yogic teachings of pranayama and fasting and long sustained meditation. And he did that for a number of years and wandered around the wandering monks of India all throughout Bihar, what was present day the state of Bihar. And living off of the donations of the people in terms of food, and he lived in the forest, and he became here too. Those other monks realized that he was just not your run-of-the-mill monk. Lots of people may decide monkhood, but not everybody gets full success in their meditation. It's not easy. But Buddha was little by little starting to surpass those. Not in a egotistical manner, but just as they saw that he had a tremendous capacity to focus the mind in meditation and to undergo difficulty in order to achieve something meaningful in life. And other people were attracted to him as well. And then one day in the town of Bodh Gaya, a place where a lot of people go to, a lot of people who are of the Buddhist tradition, they like to go to Bodh Gaya. And it's there that under the peepal tree, Buddha began to sit for meditation one day with strong determination. And interestingly, Bodh Gaya means the place of enlightenment. And it may have been named after the fact. But he sat for meditation, and his mind was wandering, and he felt weak. And then he felt he needed some refreshment. He took some rice milk. The story goes he took rice milk and it fortified him. And just after the rice milk was digested, then he took the firm vow that he was going to sit in meditation till he realized his goal. And he sat, focused the mind, and on that sitting, he achieved a very high state of realization. And that by this point, he had turned 35. And thereafter, he became known as the Buddha, that he had achieved that state of Bodhgaya, and that's where he became Buddha, means the enlightened one. And that's when, that at age 35, he gained that realization. And he had graduated out from living with the wandering monks, and he spent about 7 weeks organizing himself, getting his thoughts together. And after about 7 weeks, he gave his first lecture of the teachings of the Buddha. And that's where he decided he was going to share his wealth of knowledge with all those around him. And he started what is known as the middle path, or Madhya Marg. Not the extreme on either end, but the middle path, also known as the Eightfold Path, also known as the Ashtashilas, or Eight Shilas. And we'll go over those things. We'll go over that Eightfold Path, each by one here today, each step one by one. But something else he did, which was really, really quite remarkable. He was the first person on record to fight against the existing dogmas of the day. And that's the part, that's the thing with spirituality, that it's not enough just to be good. You have to be a fighter. You have to be ready to fight what's right, because those in power don't always want the truth to come out, because it's not convenient for them holding on to power. And so a lot of times people think that Buddha was just this, peaceful, laid back guy, and he was. But he was also focused to fight against the prevailing dogmas, because any society, when it starts getting stale, the people who are at the top start to exploit. They exploit the more they're in power, the more exploitation goes on. And there are two things that Buddha did that set him up. So he's not just an enlightened one, but he's a true revolutionary in the spirit of the term. And the first thing that he did, the first dogma that he buckled in the face of those ruling priests, the priest class of the day, the Vedas, was that he thought, I want my teachings to go to the people. So I'm not going to give it in old Sanskrit. Nobody knows old Sanskrit. I'm going to give the teaching in Magadhi, which is the local language, also known as Pali. Pali means village tongue, where even the uneducated, so-called uneducated people, everyone would be able to understand. And immediately the priest class buckled up against him. It was kind of like back in the Western world, they wanted everybody to speak in Latin. It was the language of the aristocracy, of the intelligentsia, of the intellectuals, and the common people should not be taught those things. Let them remain ignorant, let them remain indentured, let them remain bound, let them remain our slaves. Don't teach them. And those who did face backlash. And it was the same thing in the Eastern world. Don't teach in Sanskrit. They won't know the Sanskrit, only the intellectuals, the ruling class will know it. And we'll do that. Don't teach in the Pali language. That was the first dogma that he buckled. He's like, no, this spirituality, this is for everybody. Meditation's for everybody. Happy life, knowing all the secrets of life, all this is for the common people. And then the second one that he was, in the Vedic period, there were tremendous amount of incredible number of animals and large animals in those days. And they were killing them for sacrifices to the gods. Mm-hmm. And they said that the rivers were just full of blood, just, you know, for massive animal sacrifices, piling up animals and burning and slaughtering and to please the gods. And Buddha saw this, he said, whoa, this is way out of line. You know, this is not the way to, you don't get realization by destroying others. Neither is that making the gods happy, nor is that beneficial for you, nor is it beneficial for the animal. It's a total loss. And he was thinking, like Mahavir Jain, the Jainism is also strict vegetarian religion. Don't harm others. That was the main code, ahimsa. Don't inflict harm on others. And both these, Mahavir Jain and Buddha, were both big practitioners on that. And they spread that doctrine across India, that don't harm, don't preach the of mercy, of let others live the way you cherish your life. Every being, whether you find them to be petty or great, they also enjoy their life. What you think of them is not important. The fact that they've been born on this earth, they have a right to live on this earth, and they should be allowed to live according to their natural. So you cannot play God with their life per se, decide when they can die and exterminate them. That was not Satchi's role. And so Buddha spoke out about this, about these massive sacrifices that were being made. And he preached the doctrine of mercy for all beings and live and let live. And he faced tremendous backlash from that, tremendous. But he was strong-minded. He was not concerned. Those who realized, you know, their mind is fixed, they understand, they know ahead of time what they're going to face when they do something. It wasn't a surprise. He knew he was going to face backlash from that. So his mind was set and he was ready. It's just like if you know you're going to go out in the cold, then you prepare yourself ahead of time and you're prepared for it. You don't feel cold. You don't suffer from it because you have your gloves, your mittens, your boots. You're prepared for what you're about to face. Same with that.
Yeah.
So
I have a question for you.
Go for it. Yeah.
So just like you were saying at the beginning about Siddhartha's journey, is that it was kind of in his blood, right? He was born with this natural compassion. And it makes me wonder, like, what's your thoughts on how much do we cultivate and how much are we born with? You know what I mean? Like, do we come in with this propensity to love and to have compassion or to not, to be, you know, in more of a service to others space? Or is it something we cultivate? Like, how much of that do you think is learned and cultivated? And how much do you think you're born with? Do you think it's different for everyone? I'm just curious what you think.
Yeah, no, the yoga teaching on that is there's something known as sanskar, which means a tendency of mind. And people come into this world, you're born, you're inborn sanskaras based on, it doesn't believe the old Roman teaching of tabula rasa, that everybody comes in with a clean slate. No, because you're coming in from past lives and you're coming in with past experience and you have to go undergo certain events, reactions from past actions. So your mind is already formed in a particular way. So you have, part of it is inborn, and then there's also social sanskara. The community that you lived in, you're raised amongst people. Is it a vegetarian community? Is it a meat-eating community? Is it a materialistic community? Are you born into a particular religion or a particular family? So it's a combination of both. It's both. So it's not predetermined. And there's no predetermination. There's tendency, quality of mind. Ideally, you take birth in a body in a form that allows you to cultivate that. But it's a very complex topic, but it's simple. It's also simple in that there are inborn sanskaras and social sanskaras. We're all affected by our environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a vegan now, but I wasn't a vegan when I was born. I grew up, everybody was eating meat. I was doing the same. But eventually my interest changed. People are painted by their environments. You know, if a person who never drank and then goes off to college and there's a bunch of drinkers, then he'll be shaped by that, maybe, depending on his own strength of mind, his own sense of independence. So it's a mix, and it's like that for everybody. Just that's why you always want to have create a very sentient environment for the child, because what the child sees, he picks up on those qualities.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. And I loved, you know, at one particular teaching I went to with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, it was in New York. He was teaching the ways of the Bodhisattva and teaching the Bodhicitta, which is all about generating compassion. And he spoke about that very thing about, and it just always stuck with me. He said, you know, you have the seed of compassion within you. And it's determining whether you're going to water the seed and give the seed sunshine, or, you know, whether it just kind of sits as like this empty seed, and what do you choose to cultivate? And that some people have a propensity or a natural tendency to cultivate those seeds, and other people maybe don't even know those seeds exist. And it all depends on where you come from. So, you know, just to agree and affirm what you're saying, you know, that always stuck out with me is, you know, well, what am I cultivating and what am I choosing to cultivate? And all of us here together, you know, who are a part of the show right now, who are watching, you know, we're cultivating these teachings and these ideas just by being here and talking about it. So,
yeah. That's right on. And everyone has their inherent dharma. This is unique to every human being, the penchant for spirituality to expand, to realize, and depending on your inherent samskara and your social samskara, were you born into a family of yogis? I mean, okay, naturally you're going to be taught meditation at a young age. And that those two qualities, but everybody has that latent desire. It's not that nobody, some people don't have a penchant or a longing for spirituality, but were you born in an area where it was favorable or less favorable, or where's your mind? How strong was it? What kind of inclination do you have for that? Were in your last life, were you doing a lot of meditation? Or so that all those factors come into play. But that's exactly right, what you were saying about the seed and whether it gets watered or not. Everyone's got the seed, and it all depends. Watering it is based on your own inclination and who you meet along the way.
Yeah, I saw. So last weekend, we took the kids to the park near our house and just this really nice big playground. And there was a little boy. I think this little boy is probably 4 years old, Satya. There was this little boy and he was sitting, you know, there was like a big tube slide, you know, one of those slides. It's like a tube.
Yeah.
And it where it stuck out on the ground, he was sitting on top of this tube. So he was sitting on top of it with his legs crossed. In a mudra.
Oh my goodness, right.
Meditating, no joke.
Yeah.
He was doing this for like an hour, a four-year-old boy for like an hour, not moving, not playing, not doing anything, just sitting on this tube in meditation. And I thought, oh my God, this little boy. I mean, could you imagine starting that young?
Yeah. No, there are stories about a great yogi named Dhruva. And and also as a boy, he was also a great meditator. It happens.
Yeah, it was just amazing. It was so inspiring to me because I thought, man, look at the discipline of this little boy. Like if I could only be so disciplined, and I'm pretty disciplined, so I just wanted to share that because I thought you'd appreciate it. It was so cute, this little boy just meditating for an hour.
And it shows that this is people's inherent tendency to feel some sense of peace in life. And people are not born materialistic. That gets imposed. No human being is born materialistic. And hatred, all that stuff is imposed. Oh, I don't like that class of people. I don't like this group of people. No one comes in with that in mind. That gets imposed by the prevailing dogmas of the society.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say people basically come in. That's why children are innocent. You can never say that a child is. No, they learn tricks along the way that, you know, will maybe drag them into a negative path. But they come in basically, you know, with those dharmic ideals to some more degree.
Well, and don't you think that they come into, the humans come in, humans naturally or inherently want peace. I don't think we come into this world wanting war, just like this is all something like, I think it gets driven through, you know, agendas and ego and all those things. But I know in my heart that the human collective doesn't want to fight or have war or be divisive or any of those things.
No, the yogis say the one thing that everyone's looking for is happiness. That's what they want. And but in materialism, people chase after fleeting happiness, and until they realize, I need permanent happiness or perfect peace. But yeah, that's the central human want. The human desire is to find happiness. Any bad person can be converted into be a good person if you show them a better way to find happiness.
Mm-hmm. It's burned into my brain. Like I can hear His Holiness in my head say, "Everyone wants a happy life," with his accent, because He says it every single talk. Yeah. If you guys go to YouTube and watch the Dalai Lama, every single talk he's ever given in the history of him giving talks, he says at least once, "Everyone wants a happy life." And I can hear him in my head say it, because He just always says that, just like you're saying, Satyam. It's like we all just want to be happy, truly.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I love what you brought up about the dogmas too. I know I'm totally interrupting.
We're good.
I want to just share, like, it means a lot that you bring that up and remind people that the Buddha was absolutely breaking ground with what he was teaching and how he was teaching and what he was sharing. And the hardest part of any of us who are spiritual teachers or, you know, managing communities or, you know, whatever we're teaching, whether it's yoga or philosophy or any kind of religion, like it is tough because you are up against all sorts of beliefs and opinions and structures and rules and all those things. And you have to be really strong. So I like that you brought that up, because it's all about, I talk about light warriors all the time. And that comes from Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche's book, The Heart of a Warrior, and, you know, in Shambhala, and what that means to be a true warrior, in the sense that you have to hold space for everything and have compassion for everyone's beliefs. And at the same time, you're breaking through, you know, fundamental realities or rules that maybe need to be broken through.
Right. Exactly. No, he set an amazing example in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And just to backtrack here a second, I just, so people know, that if you go to Bodh Gaya these days, there's a tree there, and they have a fence around it, and that is not Buddha's tree, but they promote it as being Buddha's tree. But anyway, it's there. It's, you know, if you want to go and see there, one can see. But in Bodh Gaya also has all the Buddhist temples. But we were at the point where Buddha, which just where Lisa had just been talking, that he had broken two, not broken, but he had spoken out against two existing dogmas. One, the use of the Sanskrit language so that poor people could not get the teachings. And two, this idea of animal sacrifices and destruction of life. And one day while he was giving a lecture, two new people came in. He used to give lectures out in the mango groves. And two people came, and one became very enthralled. And then, and the other, his friend was a merchant, and he did not like losing his friend to Buddha's teachings. He felt threatened by it. And so he started to hurl insults at Buddha while he was, and calling him all sorts of names, one after another. And Buddha just remained calm, quiet, relaxed, stoic. And finally, the guy became totally exasperated and lost his energy after hurling all those insults. And he said, "How come this is not disturbing you? I'm yelling everything at you." And the Buddha understood that he was from the business community, a merchant. And he said, "Well, let me say this. If you have 1,000 rupees or $1,000, whatever the money was of the day, and you give that to someone and they accept it, then who owns that money?" He said, "Well, naturally, the person I gave it to is the owner of the money." And then he said, "Well, what about if you could take that same $1,000 or same 1,000 rupees and you give it to someone and that person rejects it, doesn't accept the donation, then who's the owner?" He said, "Well, I'll still be the owner because I tried to give it." And Buddha said, "Very good. You've been giving me all these insults, but I reject them. Those are your insults." And so the point being that just as if you try to give something, we have a lot of power as human beings to not accept all that's given to us. If someone is labeling you or slandering you or doing all those things, this is a great teaching for everyone that we only own those things if we accept them. But if we stay true and don't listen to that rubbish, then our mind will remain calm, and the person who's hurling those insults they will undergo the reaction. They become the owner of those things. And this is true that so many, you know, whether it be bullying or teasing or mocking, or we all go through that through different stages of life, whether it be from pre-K all the way up to business life or whatever it may be. And if we keep the mind calm and steady, then we will not be affected by all the shenanigans that we may encounter along the way. And that, you know, that's just a great, and it's not easy to do. You know, I struggle with it, and some people are very successful at that, but of just to remain calm, that whatever the other person is saying about you, that's their impression, that isn't you. And shame on them for trying to tear you down. It's one thing if someone did something immoral and you're trying to rectify them and you have to strongly scold or rebuke them, that's different. But if someone's just trying to tear you down for no good reason, and or they feel threatened by your goodness or your moral standard, whatever it may be, you know, keep a calm mind, stay good, they'll end up eating their words. That's kind of how it goes. And ultimately, hopefully we can help them. So that was one teaching that that people saw, that when Buddha was assailed by people who felt threatened, he never got into a shouting match with them. He just kept on keeping on in his path. So anyway, he gave the Eightfold Path. And the question is, what are those Eightfolds? He gave his first lecture in a town known as Somnath, outside of Varanasi, also known as, what's the other name of Varanasi? I forget. Anyway, it'll come to me. But Varanasi is a famous city in India, old city in India. And it's looked upon as a very spiritual place. And so the Eightfold Path, and we'll go through these little by little. This is one of his main teachings. The first one was known as Samyak Darshan. So Samyak means right or proper or appropriate or meaningful. And Darshan means philosophy. And so Buddha's guideline was follow a philosophy that is proper, that will suit you. Because not all philosophies are proper. For instance, if someone adopts the philosophy of communism, they're not going to succeed in life. It's going to be an atheistic, materialistic, exploitative, tyrannical philosophy. You know, the back half of the 20th century, people suffered horribly under those that philosophical approach. So it needs to. So when you adopt a philosophy in life, it should be universal, open, full for the welfare of others. So that was the first one, Samyak Darshan. So right philosophy. Second one was Samyak Sankalp, which means when you take a Sankalp, it means it's beyond firm determination. It's embodying that, saying that this is really what like when a mother gives birth to a child or they're in pregnancy, they take the Sankalp that they're going to care for that child. That becomes like the main, their mind is merged with that idea. It's not like they're determined. They're one with that idea. And such a person's never defeated in life. So Buddha's teaching that Sankalp, have that fixed, firm resolve to achieve your mission, whatever that mission may be. It should be benevolent, just like a mother's mission is always benevolent. The third one is Samyak Vak, V-A-K, but V in Sanskrit is pronounced like a W. And it means sentient expression, that your behavior, your dealing in the world should be sweet, sentient, refined, dynamic. And along that way, for instance, your 10 motor sensory organs, a lot of people get into a lot of trouble because of their 10 motor sensory organs. They get angry and they bop the next guy in the nose, even if it's a policeman. Or they have a desire, and that desire either because the desire to eat voraciously and they get sick, or they have a strong desire to impose their will on the opposite sex in an unjust manner. And people do horrific things because they can't control certain desires. And so Buddha gave one great teaching in that regard, and known as Chakuna Sambhado Sadhu, Sadhu Sambhado. And the yogic monks sit around and chant this a lot of times before all the meals. And it means, oh monk, be careful how you interact with this world. These 10 motor sensory organs, watch. Don't be goaded by all that you see. Let the mind be in control of the eyes. Let the mind be in control of the nose. Let the mind be in control of the tongue, the ears, all the 10 motor sensory organs. The mind should have firm control over those things. And those things should not drag the mind into the mud. And that's one of the main teachings in life. And you see so many struggles. People say, okay, today I'm going to eat a very good diet. And then they go out in town and it's a flashing neon sign and they know that food's not good for them, but the desire overpowers their initial resolve. And next thing they know, they're eating a quadruple chili dog and 6 milkshakes or whatever it may be. That happens. It happens. It happens to CEOs. It happens to heads of state. It happens to all different types of people. But to get success, the true yogi, the true aspirant, the true practitioner has control. That samyak wak, that mental stability in the face of all those and perfect control over all the organs of the body and sensory organs, motor organs of the body. And that's a great thing. If anyone can do that, they're a truly great person on this earth, regardless what their job is, where they live, how much money they have, they're a true human being. They're really someone special. Then the fourth one is samyak aju. It means right occupation, both in physical world and mental world. So right occupation, you know, like those people who create computer viruses or smuggling drugs or tampering food or doing all that. That's not the right way. That's the wrong livelihood. That's you're cheating, you're exploiting, you're deceiving. Your job in life, whatever profession you embrace, should be one of, it should be done in a proper way. And it should be one that benefits society. So that's what samyak ajiv is. And then there's another aspect of it, your mental occupation, your psychic occupation. Don't harbor ill thoughts all day long. Harbor sentient thoughts, harbor peaceful thoughts, harbor constructive and productive thoughts, not thoughts of hatred and which we all know, we all learn that teaching, maybe not in this, we may not don't know it by this name, but you know, it's easier said than done. There's a lot of get back, there's a lot of revenge and you know, tit for tat in the world. But the idea is keep the mind keep your mental occupation pure. So that's the fourth one, samyak ajiv. And then number five, samyak vyayam, right exercise. This one's very key. Right exercise, physical exercise, psychic exercise, spiritual exercise, to keep the body, the yogis sometimes say physically fit, mentally sharp, spiritually elevated, to keep on top of your existence in all three realms. And it needs training, it needs physical training, the yoga asanas, proper breathing techniques, a healthy walk every day, proper food. And then psychic exercise, learning, studying a philosophy, keeping the mind sharp, and then spiritual exercise, meditation, kirtan, contemplative activities. And this is very, very key for our successful life, in those realms. So that good exercise. And that's one thing I love about the yogic endeavor, is that throughout the day, the life is filled with one of those exercises, physical, psychic, spiritual, throughout the day in one's endeavors. Then number six one is samyak karmant. Samyak karmant means proper finishing. You know, half-baked, don't do anything half-baked. What you start, finish in a proper way. You know, if you're going to clean your room, get all the dust out. Just do the whole job right. If you're going to do anything in this world, and that's a good quality. You know, sometimes people go out to the garage to fix things. They leave halfway through. The tools are all over the place. No one else can use the garage. No one can find the tools. In all different aspects of life. So samyak karmant, whatever you're doing, finish it in the proper way. The yogis say that the greater the task, the mightier the obstacles, the more resolve is needed. And those people with proper resolve always finish up in the right manner. And then number seven is samyak smriti, meaning right memory. Don't think about the things you lost in the world. Don't think about the people who don't have a hit list. Oh, that person betrayed me there, and that person did that. We shouldn't be walking mafia bosses. The mind should be what you should remember. Remember your meditation. Remember your mantra, that I've come in this world to do something meaningful, to live a just life, and to I'm a child of the great cosmos. And this is the types of thoughts that always remember that. And the yogis say, there's a word in yoga known as dhruva smriti. It means fixed memory. The person who never forgets their true mission in life, never forgets, even when they're sleeping, their mind is involved in their mantra jap, in their incantation. And that's a great state. And one achieves that by practicing meditation daily and training the mind in that way. And materialism doesn't train the mind in that way. Materialism, you're always thinking about gaining something, short-lived gain or short-lived loss. And it doesn't train the mind in a proper way. But so we said samyak smriti, to always remember our true purpose in this world. Never forget that. Mm. And then the last one is samyak samadhi. And that means full ensconcement in the thought of the great, thought of the supreme, that it should be. Sometimes people have samadhi for money. And there are some people, when they lose a lot of money in the stock market, they might faint, or they might become, their mind becomes suspended on a negative idea. But the true samadhi is when the mind is so ensconced in the sense of perfect peace that you lose your individuality in the thought of cosmic pool of consciousness, that deep, you've lost the shackles of unit existence. That's the true samadhi, samyak samadhi, and that's also those who know about the Ashtanga yoga. The last one is samadhi. That's the culmination, the eight paths of yoga with jhamma, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and so forth. On. And then the culminating one is samadhi. And similar, same here with the eight shilas, or the eightfold path of Buddha, is samyak samadhi, that right ensconce the mind in that deep state of realization. And those are that's the middle way that he was preaching. And he went all over from the age of 35, when he first got realization sitting under that tree in Bodh Gaya, he became an octogenarian, just like the great Krishna did. Krishna was also died at the age of 80 years old, the great yogi Krishna, Sri Krishna. Buddha also lived to be 80, and the final 45 years of life, he was just going from mangrove grove to mangrove grove, giving these lectures, these darshans that they were called, and preaching his teachings all around. And for a long time in India, there were Buddhist monasteries and Buddhist temples all throughout India. That was the place, that was the birthland of Buddhism. Later on, that changed out. That's another story. But that for 45 years, he lived that way, and died at the age of 80 in 463 BC. I think he lived from 483. So he lived from 563 BC to 483 BC. That's the time frame that he was on the planet. And he died in the state Kushingar. That was where he breathed his last. But quite a remarkable life, and an interesting life. He said a lot of amazing teachings that the yogis still follow to this day. Teachings that lasted centuries and millenniums, and that people, and those teachings don't get old. That teaching of Chakuna Sambhara Sadhu, that, oh, aspirant, be careful how you interact with this world. Keep the mind balanced. That's never, humanity will always be based on mind, mental beings. Maybe we'll become small people with big, big heads and small bodies, you know, or who knows what will happen in the course of human evolution, but there'll always be mind. And so long as there's mind, there's humanity, and these teachings will live on and on and on. They don't get old. They don't get stale. They apply to all peoples across all decades and generations and contexts and communities. There'll always be exploitation in this world. This world is give and take. And we get to places where we get a relative sense of peace, but never perfect peace. It doesn't happen. Perfect peace happens in the mind, and people can have that sense of perfect peace while walking this earth. But to create it in a collective, it's always a struggle to maintain peace. There's always someone trying to come over the top to grab what's not theirs. And so, this creation goes on and on, and these teachings will be valuable from one generation to the next.
Yeah, and beautifully said. And the thing, I converted to Vajrayana Buddhism in 2011, and the thing about it for me, there's two things about it for me. One is the middle way. Being a Scorpio woman, I absolutely am a person whose pendulum swings from side to side. Mm-hmm. And so the teaching of coming to the center and coming to the middle has been beyond valuable to me. I couldn't achieve what I do today. I couldn't find my own peace without really beginning to understand and integrate and embody the teachings of the middle way. It's been just so powerful for me to be able to release, you know, these extremes that come from how the mind is reacting to the destructive emotions and what's happening in your life and in your world. And the other thing about it is I was a kid who would go and sit with my journal and stare at trees. Like I really have this philosopher spirit to myself where I just sit and think and listen to the wind and stuff like that. I have so many journal entries from being a teenager talking about how the wind spoke to me and just crazy stuff like that. And that's what I love about the Buddhist teachings, just like you're saying, how they live on and on. Mm-hmm. You could also spend a lifetime on one sentence, one mm-hmm. teaching, one thought. You could contemplate that for a lifetime and continue to have something awaken and open like every single day. And it reminds me of Lao Tzu and him holding up a flower. And that was his teaching. He literally held up a flower. And that's what he taught for the day, was everyone just stared at that flower. And I think it's so powerful to bring the complexity of the mind to something so simple as to just, you know, focus on one teaching or look at a flower and see the beauty. And it's so profound. I mean, it's changed my whole life. So I'm so glad we were talking about this today because it's so powerful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And your point is well taken that a good teaching can be learned over and over again because one's mind will become more developed and you'll see it in a new light. And what you were attracted to, you think it's greater than it was. And so that same line or that same line of text, read it one decade, read it another decade, and read it the next decade. And based on the quality of your meditation, you'll have a more profound understanding of that teaching. And that's why they become timeless like that. They don't get old. And that's meaningful. That's real. And that's what we want. Whereas materialism, you know, people, they just toss out, you get sick of things and you toss it out, you know. It's not really, it doesn't have that really beautiful, timeless, it means it needs mind and meaningful. So that, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and we've got a couple great questions. I want to address Eileen's because it's more simple than Anne's, and then I'll let you address Anne's, Satyam. But Eileen's asking if you have a book to recommend to learn more. And, you know, when I first was exposed to the Dalai Lama in a public talk, and I thought, well, geez, I want to learn some more about Buddhism. I'm not going to lie. The Idiot's Guide to Buddhism is actually a really, really great book. It's very clear and concise and explains the history and the teachings in a way that will help you understand it, because I think the Buddhist text is very complex and intellectual, considering the teaching is trying to move you away from that. It's very intellectual. So Idiot's Guide to Buddhism is really, really good if you want just like an overview of the religion or the philosophy and what it is all about. And then Anne has a question, Satyam. She said, what suggestions did the Buddha have to train yourself in right memory? How do you shed the unhelpful ones?
Yeah, meditation. Meditation that, and two things, self-analysis and meditation. Self-analysis is take time throughout the day just to take stock. It's just like if you're going on a hike, every so often you check the map to make sure you're still on the right path, that you're following the trail where you need to be. Mm-hmm. Similarly, throughout the day, check, what am I thinking about? Well, am I thinking about something I shouldn't be thinking about? Something from the past, something from a dream off in the future? And because what we think about once starts that cycle. And when they rewrite memory, they're not talking about, do you remember your biology teaching from 10th grade or 9th grade? They're talking about, what thought are you cultivating in the mind? What are you remembering again and again and again and again and again? Because what we think is what we become. And that's why it's so critical. If you think angry thoughts, you'll walk around as an angry person just because you're thinking angry thoughts. And if you think about jealousy, you become jealous. So one thing is to check in. Wait, what have I been thinking about for the last 2 hours or the last 5 hours or yesterday? And then reset the mind. We have that conscious ability to, you know what, I'm not going to. And the way to change that is to goad the mind in a positive direction. You can't think, oh, I'm not gonna think that jealous thought anymore. That will only make the jealous thought mushroom in the mind. So you have to give the mind proper food. So that's why, like with an alcoholic, you don't set them in a room with a whole bunch of empty bottles of alcohol. They'll continue to think about it. Show them art, show them drama, show them music. Go the mind in a different direction. So the memory has to be reshaped. And the memory means the one's mode of thinking. What are you thinking about? And so you go the mind, do self-analysis, take up very positive endeavors, sentient endeavors. And then ultimately, the greatest endeavor, according to the yogis, according to Buddha's teaching, and Buddha really, he was a yogi. He lived amongst the yogis. That's where. And that he was that ensconcement of mind in a spiritual ideal. And that cleans everything. And that's when one can start to achieve really that dhruva smriti, that fixed memory, where the only thing you remember in life is your walking embodiment of that inner light, of that mantra, of that extreme state of peace, no matter what's going on around you. And that's really the yogic ideal. And that's a journey for anyone. But those are the ways to do it, to take stock of how you're spending your days. What are you engaging in? What are your daily activities? Because that also affects, what movies are you watching? That has an effect on the mind. So you really have to micromanage life, self-analysis, remember what you've been thinking, and then also take some greater contemplative goal in life and meditation. So hopefully that give some inkling, and it's a practice. You know, there's no magic formula. It's a practice.
Yeah. Well, I want to give you some space at the end, Satyam, to share with everybody what you have going on in your own community and how they can connect with you and find you and all that good stuff.
Oh, sure. Renaissance Yoga, teaching live online classes 7 days a week. Yoga classes. Also have on-demand classes. So you can find me on all different places, www.renyoga.com. I'm pretty responsive I try to be very responsive to all sorts of queries. So whether you have a lifestyle question or you want to take a class or you want to discuss something, I'm always interested in that. And so you can find me there. You can find me on Instagram. But there's a new place where you can find me, and that's on the new community that just took birth just 4 or 5 days ago. Ajatakasha, how do you say it, Lisa?
That's right, Ajatakasha.
Yeah, Jatakasha. And I'm the leader of the Yogis group on that forum. And that's the new social media platform that we're all using. So I invite folks to join in there. I mean, any way you contact me, I'm pretty active. When I'm not teaching classes, I'm pretty much tied to a computer, editing, writing, communicating. It's a good life. I always look forward to folks who like to reach out with questions or to share experiences or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, I love you, Satyam, and I'm so happy to have you here again. I look forward to it each and every month. And yes, everybody, Jatakasha is live and all of the links are up here on YouTube. You can find it, the Jatakasha trailer. You can go to lisamgunshore.com. All the links are there. It's in your Google Play Store. It's in your Apple App Store. It's on the web. It's everywhere. And it's our own social community. So if you're looking to leave mainstream social media or you just like to be in a space where there's no violence, no divisive language, and it's all spirituality. It's amazing. So come on in. And I also want to welcome everybody. If you go to my website, lisamgunshore.com, we have new patron programs up there and available. If you'd like to help support the show, or if you'd like to help support the app, we would love the support to be able to keep this going. So I am asking everybody to check out our patron program as well. And we will be back. We have a brand new show on Thursday on this YouTube channel. Me and Delisa Hawking will be on for This Morning, which is going to be our new morning show every week, which is going to be all about psychic predictions and astrological forecasts. So it's going to be really fun. And we'll also be back with our Diamond Beauties on Thursday night. So just stay tuned. And so much love to you, Satyam.
Pleasure. Always a joy to come on and talk. And just a real, always one of my highlights of the month. So thank you so much. Yeah, wonderful.
Oh, well, we love it too. And thank you to everybody out there and have an amazing week. And we'll see you guys on Thursday. Great. Bye.